This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order. The time is 3:18 p.m. on Wednesday, February 4th. Members present are Representative Carrick, Representative Coulomb, Representative Freer, Representative Sadler, Representative Nelson, Co-Chair Fields, and myself, Co-Chair Hall. We have a quorum. Please silence your cell phones, and we're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Joan Wilkerson, and she will handle it. I'd like to thank Andrew Magnuson, the Labor and Commerce Committee Secretary, and Chloe Miller from the Juno LAO for their technical and teleconferencing support. We have two presentations on the agenda today. Our first presentation will be licensing for genetic counselors, followed by a second presentation on the rising cost of health care. And for the public's awareness, we anticipate the likelihood of having an extended at ease between the two presentations due to some time restrictions with the second presentation. But up first is the presentation on licensing for genetic counselors. We will hear from Monty Worthington, a certified genetic counselor. So, Mr. Worthington, please have a seat before the committee, state your full name for the record, begin your presentation, and thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Speaking of one of these?
Yes, sir.
All right. My name is Monty Worthington. So, hello, co-chairs and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, and thanks for hearing from me today. My name is Monty Worthington. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, and I'm a certified genetic counselor with a master's in human genetics and genetic counseling from Stanford University. On behalf of myself and my colleagues at the Providence Cancer Center, we want to thank the committee for considering a bill and Representative Fields for sponsoring the bill that would provide requirements for licensure for genetic counselors in Alaska. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of this important legislation. As a bit of background, I'd like to point out that Alaska is currently only one of 12 states that have not passed legislation to establish licensure for genetic counselors. There are several reasons I would like to highlight that licensure for genetic counselors in Alaska would be valuable. These include reductions in harms to patients due to genetic counseling services being provided by unqualified individuals, increasing access to genetic counseling services for Alaskans, and the economic benefits licensure would bring. Before I talk about licensure itself, though, I would like to speak to what genetic counselors do. I work as a genetic counselor at the Providence Cancer Center, where I provide care to individuals with personal and or family histories of cancer. With these patients, I gather a detailed family history as it relates to cancer and assess the likelihood of there being a heritable component to this history. I provide education on familial and hereditary cancer risks and enter into shared decision-making with my patients on whether to move forward with genetic testing, and if so, discuss options for genetic tests to order and specify the appropriate test for the patient. I disclose and interpret genetic test results and provide up-to-date risk assessment and cancer screening guidelines for patients and their family members. I provide counseling and psychosocial support to patients during their visits, particularly as it pertains to the complexity of genetic tests and their impacts on patients and their families. I sit on multidisciplinary tumor boards to provide input on appropriate patients to offer genetic testing to and the potential utility of this genetic testing. In some cases, results of genetic testing can provide information to proactively manage cancer risk for patients and their families. And in other cases, it can open up treatment modalities that may be more effective in treating a person's particular cancer than typical standard of care treatments might. Genetic counselors are employed in a wide range of clinical care, academic, laboratory, research, and biotech settings. Genetic counselors are healthcare providers with significant training and expertise in human and medical genetics, patient education, psychosocial counseling, obtained through a 2 years master level program. In the clinical care setting, genetic counselors are found in the specialties including prenatal, pediatrics, oncology, cardiology, neurology, and many other specialties. Genetic counselors are key players in appropriately integrating genetics into healthcare. We provide expertise in genetics to patients and also provide this expertise to their other healthcare providers. Working hand-in-hand with physicians and other healthcare providers, we can help to identify those individuals most appropriate for consideration of genetic testing for hereditary conditions and provide interpretation of test results to help guide their providers in managing identified genetic conditions. Within Alaska, there are currently 7 genetic counselors who work and live in Alaska, and at least 1 genetic counselor who lives here but provides genetic counseling to patients in other states. These genetic counselors work providing patient care in specialties including prenatal oncology, pediatrics, cardiology, and some other adult onset conditions. In addition, there are a number of genetic counselors who work for genetic testing labs or genetic consultancies who provide care to patients in Alaska but reside in other states. By way of example, a single hereditary cancer genetic testing lab has at least 60 genetic counselors who provide these types of services, many of them licensed in all states that offer licensure and able to practice in Alaska by default since we lack state licensure. Currently in Alaska, there is no legal standard for who can represent themselves as a genetic counselor. Licensure would provide a standard for those who present themselves as genetic counselors, and in doing so would be valuable in several ways. A few of these I would like to highlight include the following. Firstly, requirements for the licensure of genetic counselors would protect patients from harms by ensuring minimum standards to provide genetic counseling in terms of academic achievement, clinical experience, continuing education, and the skills necessary to deliver high-quality genetic counseling services. As the field of medical genetics grows, there is and will continue to be a need to provide the residents of Alaska with accurate information regarding their genetic risks and accurate interpretation of the results of genetic tests. While a couple decades ago, genetic information was utilized in only a few healthcare specialties, today it is hard to find an area of medicine where genetics does not have a role to play. Likewise, the complexity of genetic tests has continued to increase in step with this growth. Qualified genetic counselors fill this space in the healthcare field, providing the expertise to ensure the right patients are offered genetic testing, the right genetic tests are ordered for these patients, and the results of these tests are accurately interpreted for patients and their healthcare providers. Without a standard that qualifies who can be trusted to ensure this is handled with expertise, significant harms can occur. The residents of Alaska deserve to have access to professionals who have been deemed qualified by the state to help them understand the potential and actual impact of genetic information on their health. Licensure would provide this qualification for genetic counselors in Alaska. Secondly, licensure for genetic counselors would make services provided by genetic counselors more easily billable and reimbursable through private payers and Medicaid. In states that lack licensure, like Alaska, genetic counselors cannot bill pro fees through private insurance and are only able to bill incident services, making their services largely not worth the effort at reimbursement. This leaves employment opportunities in these states largely limited to those employers who value the downstream revenue, institutional expertise and credentialing, and community and patient benefit provided through genetic counselors. Likewise, among states without licensure for genetic counselors, none of the Medicaid programs list genetic counselors as enrolling providers. Licensure in Alaska could help facilitate Medicaid recognition, thereby improving access to genetic counseling services for Medicaid beneficiaries. Ultimately, these barriers to reimbursement and recognition through lack of licensure lead to more limited access for Alaska's residents to genetic counseling services. Recent changes to billing codes for genetic counselors, combined with ongoing efforts at the federal level through the recently reintroduced Access to Genetic Counselor Services Act to enable genetic counseling services to be reimbursed through Medicare, combined with state licensure, would further enhance opportunities for reimbursement and correspondingly increase access to genetic counseling services for patients in Alaska. Thirdly, this bill providing genetic licensure for genetic counselors in Alaska would enable genetic counselors to order genetic tests. And yes, you heard that correctly. Currently in Alaska, genetic counselors are not enabled to order genetic tests. We rely on our physician partners through referrals and other licensed advanced practice providers through referrals, and orders are placed under these providers' names, even though the tests are specified by genetic counselors, Results are disclosed to patients by genetic counselors and interpreted for both patients and the referring providers by genetic counselors. Licensure would enable genetic counselors to more fully perform the scope of practice, further reducing barriers that limit access and complicate healthcare for Alaskans seeking genetic counseling and genetic testing. This legislation is important to Alaska in terms of maintaining a high-quality genetic counseling workforce. In the current climate, genetic counselors from Alaska may need to seek employment outside of Alaska in states with licensure, where employment opportunities are greater. We may also have a hard time attracting new graduates from outside the state to practice here, or may not get the same caliber of graduates as states with licensure. We urge you to enact legislation that would establish requirements for the licensure of genetic counselors. This legislation will in turn reduce barriers to genetic counseling and testing for Alaska residents, while also reducing the incidence of harms associated with these services. This legislation will increase job opportunities for genetic counselors in Alaska, provide economic stimulus through enabling reimbursement for these services, and through licensing fees. In conclusion, me and my genetic counseling colleagues and I in Alaska, and many of our physician partners, are hopeful that this committee will move forward with this bill to provide genetic counseling licensure that will ensure the people of Alaska receive quality genetic counseling services. We believe the people of Alaska will be well served. We thank the chairs and this committee for your attention to this important issue, and we offer ourselves as a resource as you move forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Worthington, for your testimony and presentation. For the committee's awareness, we do anticipate hearing Co-Chair Field's bill next week. That is HB 293. That is the bill that Mr. Worthington is referencing. I also want to make a note that on the line, we also have Ms. April O'Connor. She is also a certified genetic counselor, and she has extensive experience being a genetic counselor in other states. So if there are questions related to how other states go about their licensure, she is a resource. And with that, I will turn it over to committee questions. And I believe we're going to be starting with Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the Chair, Mr. Worthington, until I saw this bill come up, I had never heard of genetic counseling. So I appreciate the little bit you told us about what it is. So I have two questions, if I may. One is, what credentials are there in the field of genetic counseling? And second, how many genetic counselors are there in Alaska? Certainly they're not licensed, but of whatever caliber.
Sure. So at the national level, there is certification for genetic counseling that's done through April, help me out with the acronym, the ABGC. She's on the line.
American Board of Genetic Counseling.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. For the record, that was Ms. April O'Connor on the line.
So that's how we're certified nationally. But there is no state, in Alaska, no state licensure. Currently, 35 states have licensure established, and two others have passed legislation and are in the rulemaking process.
And the first part of my question.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. How many genetic counselors are there in Alaska?
There's seven of us who work in Alaska and live here, and there's at least one who lives here but provides care for patients in other states.
Seven, you said?
Yeah.
Thank you.
With that, we'll turn to Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair, I also had not heard of genetic counseling before today, so I really appreciate the introduction. Are all of the seven current genetic counselors working in Anchorage, or are they spread around the state a little bit?
That's a great question. So three of us work at the Providence Cancer Center together, and it includes April, who's on the phone. There is three who provide care through the South Central Foundation and ANMC. And I'm trying to remember who the seventh one is. There is one genetic counselor who lives here in Juneau and provides care to people in other areas of the other states. Yeah.
Thank you. One
follow-up, Representative Carrick.
Thank you. I probably have a lot of questions on the subject we could save for future hearings of the bill, mm-hmm. but just through the chair, the one question you always ask about licensure is what are some of the issues of folks maybe practicing without the same kind of certification and credentials that you and some of your colleagues have. and how prevalent is that sort of outside the certified practice in Alaska? How prevalent is that?
So when you say issues, you mean like what sort of harms come about because people are practicing without licensure and maybe without qualification?
Yeah. So generally, if we're going to license a profession, I want to know that there's issues with people or potential issues with people operating outside the scope of what we're licensing. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just trying to get a sense of, do we have folks calling themselves genetic counselors without credentials? And is that a problem in Alaska? Has it been a problem in other states? Just trying to get a sense of that.
Well, I think I might see April, who has more experience with licensure and also working in other states. I mean, I don't know if you have anything to add to this question, April, and I can chime in if you don't.
And real quick, before Ms. O'Connor, you weigh in. Mr. Worthington, I understand that this is your first time testifying before a committee.
Yes.
And so I just want to let you know, if you could please follow protocol, which is when answering questions, say, through the chair, through the co-chair.
Okay.
It's just one of our standard
Understood.
Procedures.
Okay.
It's no problem whatsoever. I totally understand. It's your first time. And with that, Ms. O'Connor, are you available to answer Representative Carrick's question?
Yes, certainly. I have been a genetic counselor practicing for 21 years now, and I have seen in Alaska in the time that I've been here for 4 years practicing at the Providence Cancer Center that we do on a fairly, I would say, regular basis come across a scenario where a patient has been misinformed of potentially the inheritance pattern of a test result or is unclear of the role of genetics in their care. And the concern is that they had misinformation potentially provided by a different provider, not someone who was trained in the field of genetics. I've come across that throughout my career working in other states as well. I currently also practice cardiology for a hospital in Tennessee, and this has been a concern as well, where a test result has been misinterpreted and the individual thought that they did have the disease of concern and they were establishing care and being treated for such condition when truly based on their genetics, they were at risk to develop such condition, but they did not have that condition. And so essentially they were over-treated and risk-benefit scenario there was not appropriate for the care that they had received. So to answer your question, yes, I have seen this occur throughout my career where there were concerns for patient safeties and treatments and establishing appropriate care plans that were not correct for the patient based off of inappropriate understanding and misinterpretation of genetic test results and inheritance patterns.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. Next in the queue, we have Representative Cologne, followed by Representative my co-chair, Fields.
Thank you, Chair, through the chair. So I had a couple of questions. You can just stop me if I'm going too long. But so I'm trying to get my head wrapped around why does someone get a genetic counselor? I mean, you mentioned cancer. Maybe it's like showing markers for cancer. But can you kind of – you had at the beginning, you listed some conditions. Can you tell me, like – why somebody would want genetic counseling, like what kind of condition they have?
Sure. So through the co-chair, the way that the medical system and how we're integrated into it works is typically someone's provider, whether it's their primary care provider or a specialist, is evaluating someone for some condition. It can be anything. It could be cancer. It could be a cardio condition. And they recognize there might be a heritable component to the health condition the person is experiencing. And that's when they refer to genetic counseling. They generally refer to genetic counseling in that specialty. If it's a cardio, they're going to refer to a cardiogenetic counselor. If it's a case of a strong family history of cancer, for instance, they would refer to see one of us at the Providence Cancer Center. And our role is to step in and dig deeper into that family personal history, better assess is there likely to be a heritable component to this condition and what genetic testing might illuminate that and what it might mean for the patient's care. And is it, you know, something that's worth the patient considering and doing?
Okay, and a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So through the chair, so for the licensed genetic counselors, what is your error rate? I mean, are you pretty accurate with the testing or is there a percentage that comes across as that you guys just get it wrong?
So through the co-chair, as far as the tests themselves, those are highly accurate. The only ways that you really end up with errors from the actual test that you receive is there is a classification of genetic variants, and it ranges from pathogenic, meaning the lab is very sure it causes disease, to benign, meaning they're very sure it doesn't. But there's also likely pathogenic and likely benign, which they're pretty sure it causes disease, and there's even uncertain variants. So that's with the genetic tests themselves, we always look at those variants. How confident is the testing lab in calling that variant, and is there evidence strong that this is a disease-causing genetic variant or not? So the actual result of the test, the DNA spelling is what it is. That's really 100% accurate. How that's interpreted, there is some science behind that, that we always take our training and put the magnifying glass to that, so to speak, to assess, is this quality information that we're receiving, and is this variant classified right?
Okay, so follow up. So there is an interpretation level there, kind of like reading x-rays or reading, you know, so there is, like, sometimes you can get it wrong, or it's like, it's not just a, you don't just put in a machine and they say you have these markers and that's it.
That's right. There is a level of interpretation. Correct.
I have another question, but I can wait.
Okay. Get to somebody else. We'll definitely come back to you. Thank you, Representative Colomb. Next in the queue, we have Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Question for Ms. O'Connor or Mr. Worthington. I'm guessing it's kind of self-evident that without a sustainable billing model, which we lack now because we don't have licensure, only the very largest employers, i.e. Providence and SCF, will be able to employ genetic counselors, and presumably with licensure, with a more sustainable billing model, it could make sense for other smaller providers to have a genetic counselor. Is that an accurate assumption?
This is Monty Worthington through the co-chair. Yeah, I agree. It's accurate that it would increase employment opportunities. And I think April could have some good input on this as well if she is interested in responding.
Ms. Yeah. O'Connor?
Thank you. This is April O'Connor through the co-chair as well. Yes, this is true. Because currently, with not having licensure, it's a lot of downstream revenue. It's kind of the revenue that the company would see if they had employed a genetic counselor to drive other things. Like if someone is positive on a genetic test result for hereditary cancer, they may need additional screenings to be appropriate. And then at that point, they receive those screenings at that institution. So certainly if we can bill at a professional level, then at that point, there is more revenue that comes in directly from the service of the genetic counselor. So you are correct in saying then that at licensed states, there are more opportunities for genetic counselors. There are larger roles because it's a very wide range of various entities that can employ us because they can afford to employ us.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the pretty rapid technological advancements around people's genetic information, which, if I understand it, enables you all as part of a team to provide both better care and improve healthcare outcomes, but also more efficient care. Could you just talk a little bit more about what are some of these rapid technological advances and where does it seem like your field might be going? Thank you.
This is April. May I take this question, Monty? Would that be okay?
Please go ahead, Ms. O'Connor.
Thank you very much. Through the co-chair, yes. A lot of the field of genetics is evolving into targeted therapies, pharmacogenomics, and genetics. And so that has opened a very large role for the geneticists and genetic counselors to be able to provide genetic counseling for a patient. And then based off of what gene may be involved or the specific genetic variant, as Monty was alluding to, in the gene can then drive care. There are some targeted therapeutics where the certain gene is the driver, for example, in hereditary cardiomyopathies as well as cancer conditions, where we use that therapeutic when that gene is the driving cause of the disease state in the patient. So therefore, our ability to specifically care for this patient, have an appropriate care plan, is very much determined by their genetic status, therefore their need for genetics.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. Mr. Worthington, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Sure. Through the co-chair, I would also say in terms of genetic testing technologies, there's a wide array array of different ways to interrogate the genome, so to speak, to test for things. And knowing when you're looking for a particular disease-causing variant in a patient, which test is appropriate is one of those things where it is a constant learning curve. You can't look away from that, because if you do, you might end up ordering a test that actually isn't going to find what you're looking for in the first place. And so that's an area where we spend a lot of our time staying current with the testing technologies and making sure we are ordering the right test for the right patient.
Thank you, Mr. Worthington. Next in the queue, we have Representative Sadler, followed by Representative Cologne.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Montgomery, I'm kind of hung up on the counselor aspect of the term. I'm curious whether and to what degree genetic considerations are part of a typical diagnostic exercise in the first place. And that gets to, is a counselor, who are they counseling, and who takes responsibility for acting on the counsel? I think Representative Cologne said, are there X-ray counselors or are there X-ray diagnosticians who make decisions? And I'm still not quite hearing the case of why genetic counseling deserves its own practice.
Representative Sadler, who is that question directed to?
As I said, to Mr. Monty.
Mr. Worthington?
Worthington, pardon me.
So through the co-chair. So the title of genetic counselor has been established for more than 50 years, I think. It was when the profession of having specialists in the medical field who work with genetics came about, they were termed genetic counselors. We provide our counseling primarily to our patients. Genetic information is complex, and it doesn't just involve the individual. It also involves their families often. And there can be a lot of psychosocial concerns that come up, and we are trained to address those and to sit with a patient and walk with them through that process. And so I think, in my mind, that is the where the counseling role sort of or title is applied in the field.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Worthington. Representative Cologne.
Thank you, co-chair, through the co-chair. So my other question was, do most people that get a genetic counselor, are they adults? Do they do this with children?
Yeah, this is Monty Worthington through the co-chair. There are specialists who work in pediatrics. When there are complicated health conditions that are they're manifest in children, genetic counseling can often be a part of that, as we think of as a diagnostic odyssey, trying to figure out why maybe a child isn't developing at the same pace as their peers or something. So that is applied to pediatric conditions at times. It is also important to know when it's not appropriate. When in my profession in cancer genetics, for instance, most of the genetics I work with lead to adult onset cancer risk, not childhood onset cancer risk. And we can sometimes end up with situations where family members are very keen to test their children for things that aren't going to manifest and won't change healthcare till adulthood. And we really try to counsel these patients that it's probably not appropriate to test children, mm-hmm. and to preserve their autonomy might be a more ethical choice. It's not a hard and fast rule. Families are families and they make their own decisions, but we try to guide them through the pitfalls and benefits when it isn't going to affect care until this person reaches adulthood anyway.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Are there additional questions from the committee? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Still trying to understand the profession or the practice. So where in the value chain of diagnosis and treatment does a genetic counselor operate? You know, it sounds like you and your colleagues work for the Cancer Center in Anchorage. To be frank, who pays you? How do you get paid? Who do you work for? Who do you report to? Who signs your paycheck?
So I work for the Providence Alaska Medical System, I'm paid through the Providence Cancer Center. And because our services are not largely billable, it's one of the reasons licensure is really important. We can't recoup the cost by just billing our visits, because most of them are not billable. And if they are, they wouldn't be billable for very much. So we literally sit in the overhead of the cancer center. They provide our services. Some of the reasons they do that is it allows them for credentialing as a comprehensive cancer care center. It requires genetic counseling for them to have that certification. But at this point in time, we are paid through the overhead, more or less.
Thank you, Mr. Worthington. Are there additional questions from the committee? Representative Carrick?
Thank you, through the co-chair. I also am just really interested in the profession, don't know much about it. Is there a demand for, you know, prenatal genetic counseling so that potential parents can understand risk factors? Is that part of the profession too? And I know you mentioned prenatal counseling, but just was curious how, you know, what percentage of genetic counselors, I guess, in the country, without concrete numbers needed, but what's the general volume of genetic counselors working in oncology versus in, say, prenatal care or counseling or related professions? And I know you mentioned the breakdown of those in Alaska, but just trying to get a broader sense.
Well, through the co-chair, I would offer, if Ms. O'Connor is interested in answering this, she also works as a prenatal genetic counselor, so she might have more thorough insight than me.
Ms. O'Connor?
Thank you. Yes, April O'Connor, through the co-chair. Yes, I have actually worked as a prenatal genetic counselor my entire 21 years of my career. I currently work remotely for maternal fetal medicine specialists in Arizona, whom I've worked for since 2008, and others in other states prior to that. And to answer your question, when I graduated in 2005, the majority of genetic counselors were in the prenatal space, and it was approximately, oh goodness, about 60 to 70% of genetic counselors were prenatal. Oncology was in its infancy then, because the first two breast cancer genes, BRCA1 and 2, BRCA1, BRCA2, you may have heard of them, were found in 1994 and 96. So in 05, it was just getting started in the sort of oncology realm. And then pediatrics as well was a part of that. Now that has shifted. Now oncology is actually where the majority of genetic counselors practice across the country. It is more than 50% of the genetic counseling. Then followed by prenatal a little, but cardiology and neurology and pediatrics have filled out the rest. So yes, there is a role in prenatal genetics. The majority of the time we meet with families who are either increased risk by family history for various hereditary conditions that could affect a child, and also the unborn child as well. And we also discuss risk for things like Down syndrome, for example, which pregnancies are always at increased risk for based on maternal age most of the time, and or abnormal ultrasound indications that come up to counsel patients through whether or not we believe the etiology of that is genetic or not, and genetic counseling is appropriate. We work very closely with maternal fetal medicine specialists to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. Co-chair Fields.
Thank you. Through the chair, just to follow up on that, so my understanding is sometimes maybe an older set of parents or parents who are worried that they might have a heritable condition are able to talk with genetic counselors and actually be able to have kids because of the guidance from genetic counselors. Could you explain how that works, Ms. O'Connor?
Yes, definitely. So in states that I've worked where there's licensure, maternal fetal medicine specialists have made the decision that every patient that they see who are, as you had mentioned, older, that's typically the age of 35 or older for the mother, age 40 or older for the father, they require them or encourage them to all have genetic counseling to walk through risk, benefits, and limitations of having a child at that stage in their life due to a higher risk of a spontaneous, what we call chromosome abnormalities, like Down syndrome, for example. Also to walk through, there is a path of prenatal genetic counseling that's preconception, where IVF or reproductive endocrinologists will employ genetic counselors to walk through risks for a couple if they are experiencing having a high rate of miscarriage or inability to conceive, as about 20% of the time we do believe that that can have a genetic etiology. And American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology does have guidelines that have been in place since the 1990s moving forward, specifically for genetic testing for couples going through IVF or the prenatal space. So yes, there's a large role that us genetic counselors play there as part of our greater care team in assisting patients in those situations.
Follow up, Co-Chair Fields?
Yeah, just a statement that one of my motivations in introducing this bill is, as many families have kids a little later, I think it's really valuable to have those resources, and I certainly have friends who have you know, had a harder time having kids, and that support is really important.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you.
Are there additional questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Worthington, for your time, and also to you, Ms. O'Connor, for yours. We really appreciate your valuable expertise and presentation. As I mentioned before, we anticipate hearing House Bill 293 next week before the committee. And with that, we're going to take probably about a 10 or 15 minute at ease as we get ready for our next presentation. At ease. We are back on record, House Labor and Commerce Committee. It is 4:10 p.m. The second presentation we're going to hear today is the Rising Cost of Healthcare, Part 2. Thank you, everybody, for your patience during the at ease. We're going to have several presenters, starting with Mr. Gary Stranigan from Primera, who is available on Teams and has a presentation here for us. Mr. Stranigan, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation. And also, real quick, for the committee's awareness, we're going to hear from all the presenters first and hold questions for the end. Mr. Stranigan?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Stranigan. I'm from Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera is a not-for-profit health carrier that's been in Alaska since before statehood. Our aim is to make healthcare work better by placing the customer at the center of everything we do. Insurance is a heavily regulated and actively regulated, I might add, business. Our products are reviewed and prices approved before we can sell them. We're subject to financial and regulatory supervision and accountable for our conduct in the marketplace. And for background, the history of why insurance commissioners were created is really interesting. I'd like to share it briefly. Insurance commissioners were created to address a problem in the Wild West where unscrupulous operators would come into a town and sell all kinds of insurance at basement level prices and never be heard from or seen again. And so insurance commissioners were put in place to provide some market supervision in the marketplace so that the public would believe that there was something to the promise that they were buying with their insurance policy. In essence, insurance commissioners were created to be sure that insurers were charging enough. That's the principle of actuarial sufficiency. And when regulators or legislatures flip that over and politicize insurance pricing, especially in the national for-profit carriers, tend to exit stage left because it's not possible to do business in a successful way in an environment like that. So one key role of insurers in the construct of the United States healthcare marketplace is to put downward pressure on costs. And without a doubt, this puts us at odds with some of our provider partners now and again. And suffice it to say that one outgrowth of this is that we're not terribly sympathetic, certainly compared to them. If we could advance the slide to slide 2 at this point, I would be grateful. Okay, you've got the pie chart there. Excellent. These are Primera dollars reflected in this chart in the small and large group marketplace combined. And what's interesting is that the insurance side of it is really pretty small. About 8%. We pay commissions around 4%, taxes a couple of percentage points. There's a little sliver there, profit 0.9%, I believe it is, 65%, give or take, for health providers and 15%, give or take, for prescription drugs. The reason that I think that this chart is really important is because for decades, lawmakers have been really focusing the bulk of their attention on the 8% of this pie chart. In terms of your regulatory and financial supervision and rate of returns on the investments those businesses make, so my suggestion is that given that we're 8% of the overall picture, there's not a lot. Certainly there's no low-hanging fruit. There might be some fruit left on the tree, but there's not a lot of fruit left on that tree. And the when you zoom back, zoom out, if you will, and you look at our the American healthcare system, it's about twice as costly as most other industrialized nations, and the outcomes are not better in most cases. In a few cases, they're worse. And so it seems to me that we would be better served to figure out how we can innovate to improve upon the system we have, being mindful that tremendous investments have been made and there have been tremendous successes in health improvements. And so this chart just underscores where the opportunities lie primarily. And that's why I thought it really worthwhile to put in front of this committee today. If we could move on to the next slide, I would be grateful. Okay, I'm not able to see that, so let me make sure. Here we are, now I've got it. Okay, so this chart, you're looking at the affordability and access to the Gateway to Care slide. It just displays a few common procedures and the degree to which they're more expensive in Washington State and Alaska. Now, Primera, we do business in Washington and Alaska, and that's it. We're a licensed carrier in the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association of America. And the BCBSA has a company similar to Primera in every state in the country. We call them Blue Cousins. But I compare Washington and Alaska because we have all the data in-house. And so we know exactly how much we're paying for in-network, out-of-network, Alaska, Washington, all of it. So this has been the case for a long time. The charts have looked just like this for quite some time. But something's changed recently, and I'd like to go to the next slide. Okay, if we're on the next slide, this is an interesting chart that is new information from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, this 2024 report of cost of livings in every state in the United States. And surprisingly, it has several states have exceeded Alaska in cost of living, and Washington is now 6% higher in cost of living than Alaska is. And a few years ago, dining in Alaska, I noticed that, my goodness, I could eat at a very nice restaurant for considerably less than a similar restaurant would be in Washington State. And that actually bore out the factors pushing this cost of living in Washington higher than Alaska's are taxes, cost of housing, childcare, and restaurants are on the list. So it's really curious how those two things have flipped. And so
I think it's important to have this in the back of your mind when we're talking about the cost of health care. And people often conflate health insurance versus health care and the cost of those things. Health insurance, as that first the pie chart, that's primarily driven by the cost of health care, right? And so, there's a fine distinction, of course. In Alaska, the affordability is driven by the cost of care. And so what to do? Let's go to the next slide, if we can, please. That will be my last and final slide, maybe you're thinking mercifully. The recommendation for sustainable affordability. Now, there's not a lot of proactive things on here. There's some things that, some cautions. The repeal of the 80th percentile by the Department of Insurance a few years ago has had some positive effects, especially in the individual market in the state of Washington, where there have been reductions in premium, relatively small, that were mostly concealed by increases in the cost of care that outstripped the pace of those reductions. But this year, apart from the advanced premium tax credits expiring, our premiums actually went down 3% in the individual market. Now, consumers are seeing higher prices because Congress chose not to extend those tax credits. If you might have seen some activity, ads in various places and whatnot, in op-eds in the Anchorage Daily News, Primera was a strong supporter of extending those tax credits. And we're disappointed that they didn't, because especially in Alaska, customers need the help because insurance is so very costly. So 80th percentile, there's a few other pieces of legislation that would actually be harmful as well. The there's a network adequacy piece that's now actually been merged into Senate Bill 121 over on the other side. And we would also caution against that as well. It would encourage providers to not join networks by setting a very high, artificially setting a very high floor for out-of-network reimbursements at 450%. That would be harmful. Prior authorization is one area in which we've taken great strides. Last year, the legislature passed, I think it was unanimous, a bill that Primera, along with Jared Kosin from the Hospital Association, negotiated and came to an agreement. And it was a great example of working together on behalf of Alaskans. And I think it was a good honor of the legislative process as well, and a good outcome, one that could be modeled by other states. The final one is one that I think bears some examination, incentivized value-based care arrangements to align provider incentives with good patient outcomes. And currently, our incentives are based around fee-for-service. You pull the crank, you get paid to pull the crank, pull the crank, pull the crank, get paid, get paid, get paid. And that doesn't always align with a good patient outcome. And so value-based care arrangements are intended to address the wellness of a patient and not just the symptoms of a current condition. And so I think there's difficulty in convincing providers of signing on to that for a variety of reasons. But I think it's something that bears more exploration as a community of policy thinkers. That's what I have for you today, and I'll be happy to hang around and listen to my co-presenters and then see if there's any questions that I might be able to answer for you later.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shrinigan. Next up, we have Joseph Fong, who is the administrator at Medical Park Family Care in Anchorage. Mr. Fong, please introduce yourself and begin your presentation. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good afternoon, through the chair and co-chair. My name is Joe Fong. I'm the administrator for Medical Park Family Care. I'm actually in the room with Dr. Jill Gaskill, who's, I think, scheduled to present after me. So if we need to do it at the same time, we can. But just a quick introduction for those of you who are not aware, Medical Park Family Care is a physician-owned, locally owned primary care practice in Anchorage that has been in existence for over 52 years, I believe. The current owners are all longtime Alaskans. Dr. Gaskill went through the WAMI program. Dr. Lawfer is actually a second generation owner of Medical Park. And so we've been caring for Alaskans for many years and would love to continue to be able to do so. Unfortunately, pressures on both the cost and reimbursement side of things have are making it very difficult. So specifically around health insurance, this year, so our plan year is March to February, so we're in the process of renewing, but to renew the health insurance plan that we had in 2025 for 2026 was going to be an increase of 37%. And that, like, not reasonable. I don't understand sort of the cost containment side of things, how that can be considered a reasonable increase. What that translates into in terms of dollar figures, so for Medical Park, we actually pay for most of the costs for health insurance. In prior years, we have paid 82% of the total cost for healthcare. And so for, you know, if the cost of the insurance for the year was $10,000, we paid $8,200 of that, and then the employee pays the rest. So for that 37% increase, what that translated into for Medical Park as an employer would have been an additional $340,000 just to carry health insurance for our employees. Then the employees would have experienced the same, so a similar increase. Not sustainable, and so what we had to do was change what we were offering. We had to opt for higher deductible health plans, and we had to lower the amount of the total cost that we were paying for. So we're still, you know, relatively speaking, doing quite a bit. We are paying, for our traditional PPO plan, we are paying two-thirds of the cost, like 69, almost 70% of the total cost still. And then for the high deductible plan, we are still paying about 80% of the total cost. However, because of the increase and even with the higher deductible, that still ends up doubling the premium cost for our employees. And so you're talking about for an employee that is on a that's covering themselves, you're looking at still a cost of almost $5,000 for the year in premiums, you know. And this is still relative. I know that there are other employers in our community, healthcare and non-healthcare, where they have their employees pay the total cost. So the employees are paying several thousand dollars a month just to get healthcare coverage. And so, yeah, I think it's really hard to understand how that can be a justified increase. Being a healthcare provider, I can also share the perspective that we have coming from our patients, and then also as a recipient of payments from insurance companies. So for our patients, a lot of patients, and this is not just this year, but over the last several years, more and more patients are coming to us and say, hey, I only want services that are covered at 100% by my insurance company. That's not a good way to provide healthcare. And Dr. Gaskill will talk more about that. But not only is that not a good way to provide healthcare, it's also really hard to do, period. Just because a patient has XYZ insurance, two patients have XYZ insurance, that doesn't mean they have the same coverage. And so it's become harder and harder to actually know what the plan is. And so we've been asking our patients to unfortunately put more onus on them and say, you know, you have to find out from your insurance company what is covered and what isn't covered. It's not something that we are able to do. You know, we have 13, in this last year, we saw 13,000 individual patients. It's not possible for us to keep track of that and be able to continue to provide actual care instead of just this administrative burden. So there's that piece. And what we've also started to notice for this year in particular, seeing that a lot of patients are actually opting not to have health insurance. So we do an insurance verification before their visits. And so we have their insurance on file. And as we're verifying, we're seeing, I don't know the percentage off the top of my head, but an increased number where they had insurance coverage before, and now that plan is no longer eligible, and patients are opting not to have care. Or even if they have insurance, are asking to see if they could pay cash. And you know, we offer for our uninsured patients a cash pay discount. And in some instances, that can be less than what the insurance reimbursement is. And with patient deductibles, you know, if you have a deductible, then you're paying the full price out of pocket. And so, you know, it's really hard to understand and to navigate that for patients. Our employees are patients as well, to try to navigate that. And then the last factor is on the reimbursement side. So, you know, all these costs continue to rise on the having insurance, but for us as a provider in billing insurance and getting reimbursed, those reimbursement rates haven't increased. We have an insurance provider who our rates have not changed in almost 10 years. And the ones that we do have, you know, 2 or 3% increase a year on certain codes. So with all of those pressures, it is becoming harder and harder to provide good quality care from a clinical perspective, as well as being able to have a viable business. I think if I can also maybe mention a couple of things related to Mr. Gary's presentation about value-based care. We participate in a couple of value-based care projects. They have to be designed properly or correctly to really provide value. But, you know, I would also mention that we are part of a clinically integrated network. And so over 30 practices, primary care, specialty care in Anchorage. And when we have mentioned to Premier, and I just mentioned this to the group, but I know Gary may not be able to address this. We have mentioned to say, hey, we individually as Medical Park participate in a value-based program with you. Would you extend that to the entire network, that you'll have a greater pull, greater opportunity to provide quality care and shared savings? That conversation has gone on for 2+ years now, and there's been no movement in that direction. So, it's just really hard to sort of understand how this is a sustainable model, because from our opinion, it isn't. That concludes my statements for now. I'd be happy to answer any questions, unless you want to hear from Dr. Gaskill first.
Thank you, Mr. Fong. We'd like to move along to hear from Dr. Gaskill, please. So, Dr. Gaskill, if you could please put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
Yep. Hi, thank you to the committee for allowing me to speak. I'm Dr. Jill Gaskill. I'm an owner and physician at Medical Park Family Care. And just to preface this, I had reached out to Representative Hall about a month ago, primarily as a business owner, because I was very concerned as we were trying to make decisions for our employees about providing health insurance and realizing that we were going from a bill of $1 million to our health carrier they wanted for the same coverage $1.35 million. And that is talking about a business that covers 48 employees and with their families 92 lives. This is not a huge number of patients. And $1 million just gets you premiums. That gets you no health care. So she and I had had a discussion, and she invited me to testify. Joe covered a lot of the things about the numbers. Primarily, my concern is that small businesses in Anchorage and the private sector really are struggling to be able to recruit employees. As a healthcare provider, I have to be able to recruit nursing staff, providers, MAs. All of those people are critical to being able to provide care if you or one of your family members were to come into a clinic and be seen. It's not just a physician activity. There's a number of other people who have to be involved. And the things that allow us to recruit and retain are our ability to provide a meaningful salary and our ability to provide meaningful benefits. Right now, unfortunately, all we can provide is a health plan that has a $6,000 deductible, and that's really hard for people. If they have simple conditions like migraines or asthma, they need to be able to access medications, and those are all going to be coming out of their pocket until they hit their $6,000 deductible this year. The other thing that happened last year is that the state of Alaska did pass a law that employers need to provide paid sick leave, and we're looking at a situation now where health coverage is directly tied to the amount of sick days that patients are going to take or employees are going to take. And that hits businesses hard on that end as well. I don't know if people are very aware, but in private sector healthcare, we're losing many MAs and talented nurses to government payers. So the native healthcare system, sometimes the big hospitals can offer better benefits, but largely even in the hospitals, they're seeing employees head over to Native or head to the VA, and that's because people can get better benefits over there. I do want to address the fact that this financial conversation comes directly into the exam room when I'm talking to patients. As Joe alluded to, people will come in for, you know, a preventive exam that is supposed to be free and outside of their deductible, but we're pretty hamstrung if we can't talk about the things that are really bothering them. And we do talk about that, those things. Like, physicians are very good at listening to patients, and we're not going to cut them off and say, oh, like, you're having this problem. We're just going to ignore it because it's not part of a quote-unquote annual preventive exam. So we take care of them, but we're not really able to bill for it. And that's, you know, that's the insurance company getting care for free because of the way they've designed their plans. If patients do have things that they want to talk about or conditions that they come in for, they're very concerned about the cost of testing. Many people are using free self-pay lab testing services, or not free, but low-cost self-pay lab testing services. And what doesn't come with that is any ability for a provider to review those results. So they're not really getting care, they're getting data. Family physicians, I'm a family physician, and as family physicians, we do act in that primary care role where we are diagnosing a lot of cancers, we are managing chronic health conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, all of the things that, if left unchecked or untreated, are going to result in very expensive hospital stays on down the road. As most people are aware, if you catch a cancer early, the treatment is shorter, the treatment is successful, and that's what we need to be able to do. It's very difficult to be put in a position to, you know, stay within this box because that's all that's covered outside of somebody's deductible. I have had patients tell me that they're opting out of insurance. I've had patients tell me that they're opting out of work, that they're taking a voluntary layoff so that they can go on to Medicaid, not be employed, and have all of their health care paid for, basically for free on the Medicaid system, because they do have enough chronic health conditions that it's better for them to have the health coverage than it is for them to have a job. And I think that's a really sad state to be in when health insurance is that expensive that people are opting not to work. I do want to make one other comment. It has been in the press and has been stated, I think even by some of the insurance carriers, that part of the reason for the skyrocketing premiums and costs has to do with people taking weight loss medications. These GLP-1 injections are everywhere, and yes, a lot of people are taking them, but I know very well who pays for them and who doesn't, because every single prescription that I write has to be prior authed by me and my nurse, and so we know who's covering, and the private health insurances are not covering. The people who are taking these meds and getting them paid for by insurance are either covered through the municipality, the state, or federal government. There are a few very large employers, UPS or some of the national companies, that do cover, but local businesses like ours do not carry plans that cover GLP-1s for weight loss. So it feels very disingenuous to have that be where the blame is placed for these high costs of healthcare premiums. I would just really sincerely ask that the committee consider the way that Alaska businesses are being taken advantage of by private insurance companies in order to provide meaningful health care to our employees. People in the private sector need to have access to health insurance, and we can't just all work for governments. We need these businesses to remain in place for our economy and for our meaningful community. So I really appreciate it, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gaskill. We're going to open up for questions, and we're going to start with Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Really just a question for the future. So one of my concerns when Congress gutted Medicaid with HR1 is that and ended the enhanced premium tax credits, is it would effectively end access to affordable private insurance. And it's interesting that you're already seeing the effects of that. And I guess my request just going forward is that you continue to keep us in the loop as you see those downstream effects of that dismantling of functional federal health care. Thank you.
Are there questions from the committee for any of the presenters? Representative Sadler?
Yes, Dr. Gaskill, through the chair. You mentioned MAs. MAs, is that medical assistants?
Yes, medical assistants perform a lot of the clinical duties in outpatient clinics.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler?
No, actually, to Mr. Fong. Okay. For the question. Mr. Fong, you mentioned a term of value-based pricing or value-based product. I'm not sure what that is. Can you give me a plain English definition of what that is, please?
Sure. Through the chair and co-chair, a value-based program, it's almost very literal. So the idea, as was presented earlier, traditional way of paying for healthcare is I do something, I get paid for it. Doesn't matter what the outcome is. So a value-based program is it puts payments based on the value of the care you get. So if I do something that prevents you from getting something else, or prevents you from having future, or is around evidence-based, good quality care, then there's incentive towards that. So there's incentive to providing that type of care. And then some programs in the back end, if you show savings, will share in some of those savings between the insurance company and the provider.
Follow up.
So, Mr. Fong, through the chair, is it fair to say value-based programs are pay-for-results, not fee-for-service?
Through the chair and co-chair, yeah, that would be a simple way of saying a value-based program is to pay for outcomes, not for service.
Okay. Question.
Are there additional questions from Co-Chair Fields?
Through the chair, I appreciate you all being here. My family goes to Medical Park, and I was curious, how many other providers are there like Medical Park, kind of a local family-based primary care healthcare center? Thank you.
I don't know that we know the number of clinics in town off the top of our heads, maybe around like 10. But most, so you know, most people in Anchorage are going to be seeing a clinician in a private practice. You've got the native system and you've got neighborhood health, which is under the federally FQHC program. And you have, you know, the hospital, Providence Hospital has some clinics and they do have the residency program. But all of those kind of, you know, the ones that are not private all tend to have kind of a niche of patients that they serve, whether that's low income or sliding scale. Yeah, I mean, in town, that's the CIN that Joe was talking about, the Clinically Integrated Network, does include many of the other practices in town. It's a large number of physicians. I can't tell you how many are primary care, but we're probably in the neighborhood of around 50 primary care physicians that are all working at different practices in Anchorage to take care of this community.
Thank you, Dr. Gaskill. And a reminder for the committee, we still have Mr. Stranigan online as well for questions. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. So through the chair to Mr. Stranigan, looking at your first slide, your first about your pie chart slide, Mr. Stranigan, we see percentages. Can you put some hard numbers to what those are? What's the universe? What's 100% of which medical claims represent 69.4%?
The short answer is no. I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Sadler. The short answer is no. I'm not able to do that at this time, but that's information I could get for you without too much trouble. Is there a specific service you're interested in?
Through the chair, no, simply trying to figure out what the universe of dollars, how many dollars this is.
Okay.
How many premium dollars do you take in? And another question, I guess, maybe Kanner can answer.
Follow up.
Is should we understand that operating income 0.9% is, are you trying to say that Primero only makes a profit of 0.9%? Is that the implication from the slide?
Yes, that's through the chair, that's correct. The profit for, so, this pie chart represents our insured group business. So the state regulated business minus the individual market. So that's what's represented here. So that's the data I will get for you, but that's not the entire sum total of the revenue that we get in the state of Alaska. Yeah. That also includes our self-insured business, as well as rounding it out would be the individual market. So globally, with all inclusive, our profit for the years 2020 through 2024 was 1.5%.
Thank you. And a follow up.
Follow up.
Not knowing your business as well as you, some of the terminology you used, I'm not quite sure how to, what the state regulated minus the state, I didn't quite follow what you mean. So for a layman to understand what this covers, please.
Through the chair. So the state does not regulate the self-insured business because that's not actually insurance. Right. Those businesses that operate their health plans for their companies themselves and pay the claims themselves do so under the federal ERISA law. And so they're governed by the U.S. Department of Labor and the other departments.
So again, to make sense of that, so this chart covers what again? Please help me understand how to put this chart in context of that.
Yes. So the state-regulated business is fully insured, so we assume the risk of the claims that the employees of the business bring, so both small group and large group. That's what's included in this chart.
Thank you, Mr. Stranigan. Are there additional questions from the committee for any of the three presenters today? Representative Cologne.
Through the co-chair to Mr. Stranigan. Mr. Stranigan, I think you heard the other presenters. I'd love for you to respond to the claims that the premiums have gone up so high and that it's the insurance that they can't afford the premiums. There wasn't really much mention of the actual cost of care going up, but the premiums have gone so high that businesses can't get the insurance they need.
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative Cologne. It's not an uncommon refrain, and we're hearing it, and that's partly why we advocated so aggressively for the extension of the premium tax credits. To get help, particularly in the small business market and the individual market that those provide. And so we're disappointed when that was not extended. I did, for the first time here today, some encouraging notes about the good work that we, as part of a much larger coalition than we are, achieved in paving the way for perhaps an extension at a future date. So that's the first time I've heard optimism in the last month on that topic. Mm-hmm. But yes, the premiums are sky high. And yes, 85% of the cost of the premium is from healthcare. The cost of healthcare is sky high. The madam, I'm sorry, your name is not displayed, and I can't remember. She referenced GLP-1s, and most of our the plans that we sign up, most of the businesses do not elect to cover GLP-1s. So she was correct in saying that. The ones that do, we're aware of one, a small business, whose per member per month cost for GLP-1s is over $50 per month. And that's a spread across the group. And to put that into context, we pay about half of that for primary care. And so it's a big expense when people opt into it. Now, the degree to which it's actuarially a good risk is unknown yet, and it is having some positive effects on a wide range of people, which is why they're popular. And but especially, you know, in cases of diabetes, and in those cases we cover those drugs, but not for weight loss. It's important to characterize to qualify that. So the cost of care for those diabetes patients, we're optimistic that that might actually make sense on a go-forward basis. There are other options that are challenging. Like, I won't go into that. But there's a lot of unknowns around GLP-1s, and from both a clinical perspective as well as an actuarial one.
Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So this is Rep. Cologne. Sorry, I didn't say my name. I forgot to do that. So, I mean, we can blame the tax credit. We can blame the subsidies not happening anymore. But I think there's a bigger problem than that. So the problem was just being masked by the tax credit. So if I'm correct in this, if my premium is $100 and I have the tax credit, let's say I have to pay $50, the insurance company still gets $100 for that premium. And so what I'm trying to figure out, okay, so now the government's helping people pay the premium, but what I'm trying to figure out is what is driving the premiums up so high? Why is it staying so high? I mean, right now, it's been unmasked because the government's not helping, but it's been high for a while. So I'm just wondering if you had any thoughts around that.
Through the chair. Yeah, absolutely. We have some thoughts around that. And it's, we would suggest that the, any changes in the price of health insurance are not associated with health insurance companies. They're associated with the cost of care. We've had countless, virtually every hospital system we enter into a negotiation with, they come at us
with a 15% per year price increase request. Mm-hmm. That's a 50% increase over 3 years over already outrageously high prices. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we have some thoughts about what's behind it. And it is the cost of care. Prescription drugs does figure into it, absolutely. But the hospital side of it is the biggest piece.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Klum. I have a question. This is Co-Chair Hall. I'm having a hard time squaring up, and I think I need a little bit of education here, where, Mr. Stranigan, you're saying that the increases are associated with the cost of care. One, I'd love to hear from Dr. Gaskill or Mr. Fong about that, their opinions and comments on that. But then also, if the providers are not receiving increases in the reimbursement rates, and if it's flat over a number of years, like, I think Mr. Stranigan, can you opine on that? I'm just not really following or understanding this very well. So maybe Dr. Gaskill, would you maybe start?
Yes, please. Through the chair. So when it comes to the reimbursements to primary care, those have been flat. So we have not received any of, you know, this increase in healthcare over the last decade. The dollar amounts that are coming into our practice are the same from, and I will specify, from Premera. Their reimbursement has not gone up in 10 years. It's not as though, like, we're seeing similar numbers of patients, maybe even fewer patients. So there's not another way to do that math where you would be able to say, oh, well, actually, you are getting paid more. What we have been engaging in with other payers is some value-based contracting through clinically integrated networks, particularly with Envoy, and Premera has not been interested in participating with Envoy to date. And that may be, there may be a negotiation going on that I don't know about. But what we see from our side is, you know, higher costs, tighter plans with higher deductibles for our patients. And wherever that money is being funneled, it is not toward primary care. Unfortunately, there is good evidence when you look at the literature and at studies that have been done. If healthcare costs are funneled more toward primary care, you actually can achieve a reduction in overall healthcare costs. Funneling money to the top tier of the most expensive patients is usually not the way to do that, from what I have seen.
Thank you, Dr. Gaskill. And Mr. Stranigan? Do you have comments to offer?
Through the chair, please forgive me. I was really interested in some of those remarks, especially about primary care, but may I please get refreshed on the question to me?
Sure. I guess, well, first, can you provide some insight as far as why the reimbursements to primary care have remained flat?
Through the chair, Representative Coleman.
This is Co-Chair Hall.
Co-Chair Hall, I'm sorry, going back there. I don't have anything terribly illuminating on the flat reimbursements for primary care, and I would agree with those comments around primary care helping to address healthcare cost inflation. An interesting study I came across recently indicated that for people who have a relationship with their primary care physician, the cost of their care is 30% lower. And so you're absolutely right. It's actually something that we've begun to try and prioritize the primary care. And we have a network of primary care clinics in Washington State, 17 of them that we've opened up in the last few years. Because there remains a primary care crisis in this state. People waiting 6 months for a visit with their primary care physician. But relative to the flat reimbursements that you've experienced, number one, sorry. Number two, it's something that we need to look at. I think the broader cost of care, the 85% or the 69% on that chart for medical care is those are not fabricated numbers. Those are real numbers. And I would suspect that most of the cost increases have come from private equity firms that have built up large practices, bought up some practices, combining to make bigger practices. It's gone to ESRD care and stage renal disease care, but mostly to hospitals. And that's where we've seen the growth on the 69% of that pie chart.
Mr. Stranigan, this is Co-Chair Hall again. I appreciate the references to Washington State and what's happening with primary care there. Our focus and the focus of this committee is on what is happening in Alaska. We care most about Alaska, Alaskans, Alaska businesses, and the providers. And so I do hope that you take a look and really narrow down and figure out what is going on with these reimbursements, these flat reimbursements that are being sent to the primary care providers, because primary care is very important when it comes to just overall health in general, but then also trying to figure out, is there a looming health issue that is just going to get worse if it's not taken care of? And we need to make sure that we are doing what we can to support those primary care providers. With that, Representative Sadler, do you still have a question?
I kind of do it, and by this time of the day, it's going to be a little rhetorical through the chair. You know, I have heard the presentations. We've heard from a lot of folks that certainly health insurance costs are going up, premiums are rising, people are accepting hard deductibles, et cetera. And I'm hearing what I hope is respectfully a little bit of pee under the walnut shell game, pointing who's responsible. The doc says it's insurance. Insurance says the cost of health care. We say it's the lack of the enhanced premium, but if I were to try and tell my constituent watching this after this, why are their health insurance premiums going up, what would the two-sentence answer be from each of you three people? Why are health costs and health insurance going up? I think I heard Mr. Schrangen say it's the greedy private equity people buying practices. Okay. Then Mr. Fong and Ms. Gaskell, Dr. Gaskell.
It's not because it's coming to me. Well, I mean, all I can surmise is that there is very expensive care in the acute and hyperacute setting that is being prioritized over the preventive side of things.
Could you say that again a little bit plainer for me, please? Hyperacute.
The question is, why are healthcare premiums going so high?
Yes.
I can't answer that. Plainly, I just can tell you it's not because it's coming into primary care, outpatient medicine. That's not where the expense is. If there's high expense, it's coming at the highest levels of care in the hospitals, ICUs, and procedural settings. High dollar things are not happening in primary care offices.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Fong?
Thank you, Dr. Yep.
Through the chair, Co-Chair, I would agree with what Dr. Gaskell said. The increasing cost is not coming from primary care, from preventive services. It's coming from the specialty cares.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fong. You. Mr. Stranigan, do you have any comments or thoughts on Representative Sadler's question?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I would say it's the cost of care. It's also important to note that insurance companies are regulated. All of our books are checked, and our prices and products are approved before we can sell them. None of those things that I just said are true about the provider side, the largest share of that pie.
Mr. Stranigan, would you concur with Dr. Gaskell and Mr. Fong that the increased costs are due to the specialty care?
I think there's truth in that, absolutely, through the chair, absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Sadler?
Thank you. And through the chair, to probe that, when you say the cost of care, I think it's a little bit, things cost a lot because they're expensive. When you say the cost of care versus overhead versus what do you mean by the cost of care? Medical services provided by physicians? Please expand on what you mean by cost of care, please.
through the chair, Representative Sadler, it runs the gamut. It's medical services, whether they're critical care services, heroic services, whatever they are, the price of those services is going up on a unit cost basis and in 2025, a utilization. So a number of widgets and the cost of those widgets both went up in 2025.
The liquidity?
No, I didn't articulate very well. Forgive me.
No.
I went to the kind of a base level. The number of the widgets went up and the cost of the widgets went
widgets,
up.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. That was a Latin term I hadn't heard before, but okay, gotcha.
Yeah, that one.
Are there additional questions from the committee? Seeing and hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Stranigan, and Mr. Fong, and Dr. Gaskill for making yourselves available this afternoon. We certainly appreciate it. It's been rather enlightening. This will conclude our business for today. The House Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Friday, February 6th at 3:15 p.m. This meeting is adjourned at 5:05 p.m.